Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's January 3rd, 2012. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, here tonight with Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger.
Hey, Jimmy.
How are you, Dave?
Very good.
Well, it's a new year.
It is a new year.
And you know what we're going to be drinking tonight?
What are we going to be drinking?
Spirits and beer from Vermont.
Oh, all my resolutions in one shot. That's good. I like that.
That's good. Let's give a shout out to our sponsor, GreatBrewers.com. Thanks for sponsoring us here at Beer Sessions Radio. GreatBrewers.com brings the American beer community together. We're also supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 34 New York City beer bars, GoodBrewerSeal.com. All right. Dave, what did you bring me? Bar Hill Gin. What is this stuff?
Well, the theme of this show is Vermont, and so I actually didn't bring this.
Stretching across the table there.
Todd Hardy brought this, and actually Todd's going to tell us very quickly about it. Todd's a good friend from up in the Northeast Kingdom, up Sean Hill, Hill Farmstead Way in the Greensboro, Hardwick area. And he started a new distillery up there after a long stint of beekeeping. And Todd, you want to tell us a little bit about how you wound up going from making honey to making gin?
Happy to be here. And we use New York honey from upstate New York. And I've been with the bees for 46 years, and we're trying to work with the bees and continue. And we're from a long line of farmers that have value-added products and bring the fruit of the earth to the marketplace, and we're very grateful to be bringing our Bar Hill Gin and Bar Hill Vodka to Brooklyn and Manhattan and to share it with you. I'm the messenger. I'm the bee on the wall tonight.
So so he's brought his gin and his vodka, both made with, one is made completely from honey, that's the vodka.
Yeah.
The gin is made with honey. It's kind of interesting because when he is available in this marketplace, it'll be through Union Beer, which has always been a beer distributorship, and now we're getting into spirit. So that's kind of an interesting a new take, bringing together artisanal spirits with the artisanal beers that they're already doing. So it'll be kind of an interesting trend.
It seems to be a trend. You know, if you're into craft beer, I would think artisanal spirits is the way to finish it. I love to, nothing more than having a few beers and finishing off with a nice spirit. Nice grappa.
I didn't know that was legal. I didn't know the beer guys could bring booze too.
Yeah, no, I was kind of surprised too.
Well, we're on the air, so you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
We're allowed to drink it together. I mean, but they actually can sell it together too, which is good. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, are we allowed to drink this right now? Or
I think you can. We're on
even
the air.
Even though this is a beer show, it's like we're allowed to have a little spirits.
I think
Todd,
on the air.
Can we open this?
This is a gift.
Oh,
Happy New Year!
All right.
Thanks, Todd.
We want to share the pleasure.
Well, one reason we started talking about Vermont, besides the fact that you're from there, and you've got all your great buddies up there, you got Sean Hill.
Yeah.
Sean Lawson.
Yeah.
And any other noted brewers up there?
Well, we got John and Jen Kimmick at The Alchemist. And they've just opened up a new production facility right after Hurricane Irene. They opened up that first week of September. And I'm going to let Todd do that. And that's been going really well. In fact, I went up there to get some Heady Topper before I came down on Friday and got the last case. They're running out every week, even though they're making 30-barrel batches, two 15-barrel batches a week. So they've been doing great. Sean Lawson just put in a new 7-barrel system, so he's gone from 1 barrel to 7. And Sean Hill just finished his putting in his 15 barrel system, going from 7 to 15. So they're all expanding really well and doing really well. And
yeah, those are two breweries that we hear more about. People always ask for Hill Farmstead. And has anyone had Lawson's in New York?
Illegally, yes.
Yeah, they're not distributed here.
They're not distributed here. But we do that Vermont Beer and Cheese event at the Tiger every year, and he usually gives me two sixtels for that. And so that's really the only time it's been here. But it's such good beer. I mean, yeah, you want it.
Yeah, I want to try it.
We got Jay here, Jay Steinhauer from American Beer.
Hi.
Hey, man.
How you guys doing?
Good. You guys always have these great small brands. One of my new favorites is Crossroads. Not from Vermont, but it's up in Athens, New York.
Well, they're all the kind of scale we're looking for. We're looking for little guys that do exquisite liquid and not enough to spread around to the grocery store, so to speak. And then we can all have a taste.
Important part of the beer scene, being a small distributor, taking on some new brands.
Yeah, we're always looking for new stuff. And, obviously the history has been we've graduated. A lot of other brands have gone on to be bigger and more noted in the craft segment, but we're always looking for the little guy or somebody that fits us right, that can do the whole gamut.
What are some of the brands that started with you guys?
The company I work for started out were like Dogfish and Victory and Blue Point. Those were like kind of the three first ones they put their hooks into. When I started up with them, we did Captain Lawrence for 4 years. That's been about a year, so we stopped handling that. So like I always say, the people I talk to, I'm looking for more ammo, because there's...
And you used to have Shelton Brothers too, right?
Oh yeah, we did Shelton. Yeah. We did Global Beer, which was like Golden Drach and Perrot and a lot of those Belgian beers. There was a whole another import portfolio there. I mean, we did Anderson Valley back in the day. There's a lot of beers that we've touched and that have gone on to do good in market, under our guys. And then obviously if they want to graduate to another scale, they've gone on to work with big distributors, and that's I always say it's like top 40 music. We're the independent label, and then if you want to go top 40, you have to have an agent out there pushing it for you.
All right, so you're an important part of the New York City beer scene, which is pretty cool. And one beer that you guys represent, it's one reason we're talking about Vermont tonight, is Ray McNeil's beers from Vermont. I've only met Ray once. A year ago, he came to New York for the New York City Brewers Choice event, and I was struck by his tie-dye T-shirt and bright blue color schemes.
He's got his own way of dressing.
Definitely, but we're going to be talking to him a little bit, but we are drinking his beers right now. And why don't you tell us a little bit about his beers and how you guys started distributing him?
Well, Ray's been at it for a long time. I believe it's 20, 21 years this year. He's had a brew pub in Brattleboro, Vermont, and it was about 2 years ago, a little more than that I took a ride up there with a gentleman I work with, Joe, from American, and he was kind of getting ready to come into market, and so we kind of seemed to be a good fit for one another. I would often characterize, he does pretty rustic beers. I have to say, they're not real like polished up. Like if you look at what he's done over 20 years of time, like he has a really wide array of styles that he's done, mostly English, which I like about that. Like he doesn't wait to do a lot of filtration on a lot of it. So there's a real natural body to a lot of his beers, but stylistically, he's all over the board. So it's been a lot of fun working with him. I mean, we obviously do a lot more draft than we do packaged product from him, but his flagships are good, the one-offs are great. It's fun though, because he's an individual that he brews to the beat of his own drum, and so it's always fun to see what Ray's gonna have in the pipeline for us next. And so we kind of like rock the same ones all the time, but also there's some weirdos that come along. And
what are some of the beer names?
Well, I brought it today. We haven't gotten around to tasting it, but we brought the Slop Bucket Brown, which is a double brown ale. I want to ask him again what the percentage on that was, but I want to say it's rates in around 7.5. And that one's interesting. Like I haven't had many double browns ever to sell the career that I've had. A couple. But some of the things I like from him the most are some of the most not assertive beers. I love his ESB. His amber is excellent, one of the best.
It's like one of the hoppiest ambers out there.
Yeah,
it was funny, fantastic. When he first started, like in the he started early 90s, but in the mid 90s when I first started drinking his beer, it was like very West Coast at the time in comparison to what was going on. Even though it was sort of, you know, supposedly English style, it was very hop forward.
Sure.
For the time. And, you know, now sort of like everything's caught up with him. So now it's sort of more in the mainstream. But when he first came out, I mean, he was definitely, he was winning tons of medals at GABF.
Sure.
And you know, one of the most successful East Coast brewers at that time. So it's kind of interesting now. It's great.
Yeah, I've learned a lot speaking with him. Like, he's very on point about the way he wants to make beer. You know what I mean? It's a chemical process, basically, and he's hell-bent on making sure that it, you know, he's very critical on himself and other beers that I've encountered with him. You know what I mean? Like, he'll tear it apart in 2 seconds, but that's what it needs to be. You know, that's what you want to hear from somebody who's brewing high-caliber beer, but also a lot of it for years was coming through his own establishment. And so, you know, it was exciting for us because there was a lot of brand recognition here in New York. I mean, it's obviously not like people clamoring for the same brand all the time that we don't get here. It's not Bell's or anything like that. But on the other hand, it is an establishment. It was a destination to go to for all these years.
Yeah, you had to go through it to get to skiing. You know?
Yes,
so
exactly.
It's like, so everybody, a lot of people were familiar with it.
There was a lot of good stories coming back, you know, about the beer. So for years, we knew it was something to...
A lot of our regulars, I mean, would just talk about it all the time. You know, when are you going to get McNeil's?
Yeah.
I mean, for years. And so it's, yeah, it's great to see it. It's great to see it actually in New York legally now.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we've registered a lot of the labels. You know what I mean? Throughout the course of the year, I mean, we probably have 14 beers that were legit to sell. So if he has something coming down the road that's like, okay, well, we're going to be able to put this in the market, you know, we'll go ahead and make sure it's registered and all that good stuff. But on the other hand, we put a lot out there. So it's like some of the products aren't available year-round because it's his brew cycle. You know, we're not saying just fill the order so we can put more in the market. It actually is like, here's what I'm making. It's kind of, you know, it's a trip to deal with because, like, what's going to be next? I like saying he's like the crazy wizard up north. You know what I mean? Like, the stuff is great, and who knows what's going to be on the horizon. And so every year we've picked up new labels. And so, for instance, this one that we just got is, I didn't see it coming. I like that. Left hook.
Yeah. And the other thing, Jimmy and I were talking before the show about pricing and stuff and how prices just keep going up and up and up. And Ray's beers have always been very, very affordable. You know, like very good beer at a very good price.
I agree. I think for quality and what you're getting for, I mean, there's so much beer available on market. As buyers, you guys see this stuff. You know, as somebody that's selling, you know, when we talk to breweries, we say to them, make your money first. Don't worry. We'll put the points on it, and then we'll put it into market, and that's the way it should be. I mean, I do distribution. We're a middleman. I understand that. You know what I mean? And so it's like we are in the same margin on everything. But on the other hand, we say to the brewers, make sure you get what you need out of the product because you're buying ingredient. You know, it's your time. It's your tanks. You know what I mean? It's they had to make sure that they make their money so they can sustain. And so it's not a price war for us. I'd rather say I have great product and we go to market, and Raise is one of the ones I'd like to champion all the time.
So how does it work, like, in the real world? You got these great little small breweries up in Vermont, distributor in New York. Like, how does the beer get from there to here?
We typically will speak to them about saying what are they producing, and then once it's ready and racked, we schedule freighting. So we'll hire a shipping company to go pick it up, and then we'll try to get it here as directly and as fast and fresh and as possible, and then we'll put it in our coolers, and then we go out to market and, you know, start selling it. I'm not a big guy on pre-selling. You know, I believe it when I see it, when it's in you know, my vicinity. It's in our warehouse.
So you don't jump in a pickup truck and go pick up some kegs and come back?
No, I'll throw it in my truck and bring it to your bar, though. Worst case scenario.
Full service. I like
that.
Yeah,
that's right, man, with a smile.
And what about for you, Dave? Your buddies up there, like Sean Hill, I mean, do they have the same relationship? They
yep.
get an order to the city and they
right.
load
with
the truck?
He's with Union, and when he's ready, when he's got a shipment ready to go, they'll send up a truck to pick it up.
I always forget the nuts and bolts of beer. And I'm drinking this really great beer. What is this, Dead Horse IPA?
Yeah, we've been trying the Dead Horse IPA.
I'm drinking this, and to me, it's like, hey, beer comes to me. This is great. But...
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that part of it.
I just can't. The logistics of getting beer to me, it's pretty intense. I don't know how it works.
Yeah,
I really don't understand.
And like a lot of those small breweries up there are self-distributing. You know, it's the only way they can really make it. And I'm sure Ray did that in the beginning, but he doesn't. Sure. He doesn't do that now, I don't think. And no. But Sean does. Sean started his own distribution company. Both Sean Lawson and Sean Hill. Sean Hill's distributing also for Shelton Brothers in Vermont. You know, so in his retail shop at the brewery, he's got all kinds of great beers besides his own for sale, including Anchorage. You know, Gabe, who we spoke to on the phone a few weeks ago, and stuff. So, but they, you know, you kind of have to do that. You know, up there, it's a small state. You kind of have to do everything. That's kind of the way it works.
I think a lot of breweries do that, though. When they're getting started and it's their home state and they're not going... I mean, basically, when you cross the state line, that's when you got to worry about talking to other people. Other than that, you know, you're going to sell every drop you're going to make. Why sell it to somebody else first to sell it to them later when you could just go out there yourself and make those relationships concrete on your own? But I see a lot of breweries I talk to that are small, you know, throughout New England and this vicinity of the country. They're out there initially. I mean, Captain Lawrence is a perfect example. He still holds his rights to his home territory. You know what I mean? I'm not handling
it. He wants that FaceTime with his customers and stuff.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's quality control going on. Yeah. There's more coin to be earned out of the entire arrangement. And the establishments that are buying it from them are happier probably to buy it from the brewery than they am, you know, buying it from the guys that sling them Bud and Coors.
That's right.
Jay, what's coin?
That's called loot where I'm from, or scratch.
Actually, you know, I wanted to quickly ask Todd, how do you do distribution with spirits? I know how you do when you leave your own market, but how do you do it in Vermont? Do you self-distribute, or do you have somebody?
Vermont is unique in that the state is the distributor. We bring it to the state warehouse in Montpelier, and then their trucks bring it to their agencies.
To their controlled state liquor stores. I forgot about that. Yeah, that's and I think the way I don't own a retail establishment in Vermont, but I think that we as a retailer have to buy from the same place that the the consumer does, right? I mean, and we don't get any if you're a retailer up there, you don't get any special deal. There's no wholesale price. Is that true?
That's true for Vermont. And that's, you know, a little challenge for the retailers. What's great about Vermont is that the state allows us to sell at farmers markets and at our distillery in Hardwick. And that's how we build relationship with the customer. New York State is the same with distilleries and wineries supporting on-premise sales at the site of manufacturing. It's very important that we sell directly. And it's a small part of our work, but it builds relationship. And then those customers go out to restaurants and bars and agencies throughout, you know, Vermont, and it helps us really get into the marketplace. So we're grateful for that.
All right. Hey, well, we're going to take a short break here on Beer Assassins Radio. We'll be back with Ray McNeil on the phone from Vermont.
Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople, so if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul. Now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni here with Dave Brodwick, and we're talking about Vermont beer and spirits today. And we got a good buddy on the phone, one of the early leaders of the craft beer movement, Ray McNeil from McNeil's up in Brattleboro, Vermont. Ray, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm right here.
How are you, buddy?
I'm okay, thank you. How's it going down there?
Good, man. We know you weren't feeling so well, and we wanted to make sure we got to talk to you on the air.
So. Yep.
How are you feeling, Ray? How are you doing physically?
I have arthritis of the everything, but otherwise, I'm okay. I've canceled my plans for the 2012 Olympics, and I'm looking ahead to 2016 at this point.
All right.
Very good.
Well, we're drinking some of your beers, and we love them. We had the Dead Horse IPA, Blonde Bombshell. What else do we have here, Jay?
I also brought the Slop Bucket Brown and the Pullman's Porter for us to sample. How's it going, Ray?
Good. Hey, did you guys, I mailed some beers to Brooklyn last week. Did they arrive?
Yeah, we got Brie O'Connor's here, our producer. She brought them in. She's having a good time tonight. Yeah. So.
they have them in the control booth. They didn't even give them to us.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So, Ray, you're a cool guy. I mean, Dave was telling us about how early days when you got started. Would you tell us in your own words like how you got started? Because we think you have a pretty good story.
Well, 25 years ago, I kind of fell into the bar business. I was a grad student in music performance at CUNY Queens, and I became good friends with the folks at the late Catamount Brewery. We sold a lot of their beer in my bar. And eventually I went to, I say to work for them, but usually when you work for somebody, you get paid. I was an apprentice brewer for a year. I worked part-time for free for a year. And then I started making beer here at my bar. That was almost 21 years. It was actually 21 years ago today, I think.
Nice.
1990?
Yeah, exactly.
Today.
Yeah,
wow, that's pretty cool.
Of, January in 1990.
So, and was it really hard to get licensing back then? I mean, that was a very new thing.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, there wasn't an internet then, so everything happened by mail. Everything was very slow. I think the TTB, formerly known as Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, didn't really know what to make of people like myself doing what we were doing. There were a few people who were a little farther ahead of the curve than we were in terms of pub breweries. Most of them are gone. I think the only ones were Gritty McDuff's in Portland, the Northampton Brewery, and the Vermont Pub and Brewery in Burlington were the only people around before us, at least if there were any others. They're long gone at this point. It was a learning curve all the way around, I think.
And so, and then when did you won a bunch of medals at GABF. When did that start to happen? When did you start to get really noticed on a more national scale?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I think people have been trying to ignore me all my life. But,
that's you personally, but I mean the beer. No,
just kidding. Yeah. I won my first GABF medal in 94, and I don't think that really turned anybody's heads. I think it was the next year. I won a gold medal the next year, and I got honorable mention for a second beer. And then all of a sudden, I think that turned a few heads at the time. People thought, hey, this is not just a flash in the pan. Since then, we've won an average between there and the World Beer Cup and the U.S. Beer Tasting Championships. We won about one a year. there was a period about 4 or 5 years where it didn't enter any competitions when I was building this second brewery. It was 95. We started bottling beer by hand and distributing ourselves, and it's kind of funny. There was a big beer festival at the Javits Center in Manhattan that we went to, and they were all the big names were in attendance, many of which are gone also, but like Pete's Wicked and Sam Adams and Sierra Nevada and. There was a writer for the weekend magazine of the London Financial Times, and they did an article on American beers or American breweries to look for, and they chose three or four of them, Sam Adams, Sierra Nevada, I don't remember who else, and they chose us. We were making 200 barrels a year. I was making 200 barrels a year in the basement, working by myself, and we started to get phone calls from Britain. People wanted to import the beer.
Yeah, you barely had enough for your own pub.
We didn't have we didn't have beer beyond Elliott Street in Brattleboro at the time. It was pretty silly. I actually kept some of the numbers, names and numbers for a while. I don't know why.
Just in case.
And the preceding years, in 97, 98, as we continued to garner medals and stuff, I fielded phone calls from distributors from all over, really. We were still very tiny, but I got phone calls from Florida and Colorado and all over the Northeast, and that's before. Now there's millions of brewers to choose from, and we're still at it.
With that new the new brewery that you have, how many barrels are you able to produce now?
I don't know. I think in 2012, I guess we're probably going to make, 3,000 barrels. It could change. I really don't know. We just this past summer, a distributor from Minneapolis, believe it or not, came looking for us. I've been lucky in that regard that sometimes I've had to go look for distributors, but they very often come looking for us. And so he's sort of the new kid on the block and my new best friend. They're buying an awful lot of beer, believe it or not.
Jay, you've been replaced.
Oh, man, I need friends.
Yeah.
Well, Ray, way back in the old days, back when you got started, Ray. Sorry, man. When you got started, when you had the brew pub, did you sell other beers besides your own?
Originally, of course, we did, yeah. We had, I don't remember now because this is ancient history, but we probably had 16 or 18 beers on tap, and none of them were mine. And then one by one, they got replaced with mine, and the other beers just stopped selling. Nobody drank them anymore. And I'm talking about an evolution that took probably 3 or 4 years, beginning... And, say 91 to 95. And unfortunately, finally gave up on Catamount Amber, which was one of my promises to those guys way back when that I would always sell their beer. But it just didn't sell anymore. And, of course, eventually they went away anyway.
Well, your Amber is so good anyways.
Yeah. One kind of interesting thing is that I was... I guess Gritty's was there before me, but I was certainly one of the first in the United States to have beer engines. We had beer engines, I think, by 92, and nobody knew what they were. So anyway, now there are a lot of bars, even in New York City, just just beer bars that have beer engines is fairly common.
So back then, you were making your own casks, cask style ale.
Yeah, way back when. Yeah, we were, you know, us and I guess Gritty's were the first ones on the East Coast, and I have no idea what people were doing on the West Coast back in '92.
Yeah, I remember some of my favorite cask ale was Dead Horse on the beer engine. I'd go in there, and it was just such an amazing beer.
Oh, great. Is this Dave?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Dave. Yeah, so we had to, I actually had to import those things myself, and I don't even want to tell you what I paid for them. I think I paid $2,000 for them 20 years ago. Now I think that they're, well, that was for a three-pole engine. Now they're half that price, and that was 20 years ago. But
there's a guy in Pennsylvania, Phil Pendick. What's his company called?
Yeah, it's like UK Brewing Supplies.
UK Brewing Supplies, yeah. He's been around for a while.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a lot more accessible now.
Yeah. Yeah, Pendick is another one of those minor hygiene. Ed Stebbins at... Ed Gritty's is the one who clued me into them. The thing has worked flawlessly for God knows how many pints. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands, probably. We've never done one minute of repair on them. So,
wow.
Yeah, been lucky.
Ray, what's your favorite style of beer to make? Kind of a general question.
Gee, to make or to drink? They're all, I guess they're all... Making them is all, I don't know, it's kind of all the same. You know, the differences in malt and hops, we don't do any decoction mashing anymore. I've done a number of decoction mashes myself. I guess those are more interesting just because they're more complicated. What is my favorite?
Ray? What's a decoction mash?
What is a decoction? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a decoction is a traditional Central European mashing. Decoction dates to a time when it predates the thermometer, is to be precise. When men did not have a thermometer, we only knew three temperatures. We knew freezing, because you could see it. We knew boiling, because you could see that. And we knew blood temperature, more or less. So in classic triple decoction, brewers would mash in their malt at blood temperature water, and then remove a portion that was measurable and boil it and return it to the main mash. And that was originally done three times. It's very labor intensive. Nobody does that. To the best of my knowledge, nobody in the world does that. It later became reduced to double decoction. I've done a bunch of those myself. I don't think anybody in the world ever does double decoctions anymore. In fact, I'm not sure if anybody does any decoctions anymore. But
I think Live Oak down in Austin is doing single. That's about the only one I know.
There may be some breweries in Central Europe, in Germany and the Czech Republic, that are doing single decoctions still. It's very labor intensive. It's time intensive, and it takes a lot of energy. So there's a lot of there's a lot of incentive to get away from it, but it was a way to make very clear beer with under-modified malt, poorly modified malt, poorly made malt, basically, compensate for that.
Wow. Hey, Ray, we're going to take a short break, and will you stay on with us?
Awesome. I'll be right here.
All right. So we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
Creme de la creme of the chess world, in a show with everything but Yul Brynner. Time flies, doesn't seem a minute since the Tyrolean spa had the chess bars in it. All change, don't you know that when you play at this level, there's no ordinary venue. It's Iceland, or the Philippines, or Hastings, or this place.
One night in Bangkok. his brother.
It's a drag, it's a bore. It's sweet as such a pity to be looking at the bar, not looking at the city.
What do you mean? You've seen one crowded, polluted, thinking town.
Sweet girls, warm and sweet. Warm sweet. Summer set up, make the summer set up.
You're talking to a tourist whose every move's among the purest. I get my kids above the waistline, sunshine.
One night in Bangkok makes the heart man humble. Not much between despair and ecstasy. One night in Bangkok and the tough guys crumble. Can't be too careful with your company. I can feel the devil walking next to me.
More than would a muddy old river or reclining Buddha. Thank God I'm only watching the game, controlling it.
Hey, welcome back. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Here we are talking to Ray McNeil up in Brattleboro, Vermont, Dave Broderick, Jay Steinhauer from American Jimmy Carboni,
Todd Hardy,
our secret friend with spirits from the North Country, Todd Hardy. Hey, Ray. How are you, buddy?
I'm still here.
I know, because we're drinking a beer that we all like. And what's it called, Jay?
That's been the Slop Bucket Brown so far, Ray.
We like the Slop Bucket Brown. That's our favorite
one. It's delicious.
Oh, I was going to guess if you all liked it that it must not have been something that I made.
Well, we know who we're talking to, and we did invite you on the show, and we actually do like your beer, so can't get out of that one. But the Slop Bucket Brown.
You guys are drinking Slop Bucket, huh? Okay, well, that's the new Slop Bucket. It came out of a bottle, I assume?
No, I poured a growler off from American Beer before I came over.
Oh, I see. Hey, Jay. It's going to be an interesting show from this point forward.
Mm-hmm.
That beer is absolute rocket fuel.
Yeah. Is it really? How strong is it?
How strong was it supposed to be, or how strong is it?
How strong is it?
It was supposed to be 8.5% ABV, but I think the fermentation was a little overzealous. It went a little farther than I anticipated, and I'm going to change the mash a little bit so that doesn't happen next time, but it's got to be over 9% alcohol by volume.
Seriously,
thanks,
smooth.
Thanks for warning me, man. I just drank a whole glass of it.
Yeah, no, I just drank a glass of it. It's very
smooth.
So
when did you first come up with the Slop Bucket Brown, the original recipe?
Well, the original, where did it come up from? Well, they all came out of my head. Typically, what I did in the past was I would pick a type of beer that I wanted to make. That one would have been, say, American Brown Ale. And then I would try to figure out what brewers traditionally might have used or in terms of malt or hops to try and make that beer. That particular beer doesn't have a tradition, or it didn't have a tradition, so that was a relatively modern thing. But let's say, for instance, Bavarian Pilsner. Then, I would try to figure out what I would do to make that beer if I were a Bavarian brewer, and then come up with malts and hops that were typical for that style before I tried to imitate. In other words, I tried to educate myself about beer styles as much as I could before I tried to make something. It's one reason I basically never made types of beer that I didn't like, because I was unable to wrap my brain around it. Either couldn't get interested in, couldn't do the homework that was required, wasn't interested in tasting them or drinking them, so I just never bothered. So if you look at my entire portfolio from a distance, you might say, hey, there's some gaping holes in here. I never particularly cared for Belgian beers in general, and we've only made one. I like doubles, and we have made a double a few times pretty successfully. But there are no triples. There are no farmhouse blondes or any of the other odd Belgian type of beers.
You know, we just drank your Blonde Bombshell a little bit ago, and, you know, the thing, you know, when we first had it here in New York to sell was, like, this is not a Belgian blonde, and it's cool to hear you say that, this fact that, you know, it doesn't have that nature to it, you know what I mean? It was your blonde rather than, I think, I'm talking to you now because I sell your beer, but I think it's interesting that, like, you say you haven't made a lot of Belgian beers, and yet...
Well, I will say this.
Awesome. We just drank it again. It was really good. I haven't had it in months.
I will say, Ray, I like talking to you, hearing you tell us about your beers, because we do like them. But what is this one again? The Slot Bucket, what? Brown?
Slot Bucket Double Brown.
Ray's got great names for
now
his
beers. A Double Brown. Is that what happened, Ray?
What happened to that beer is I kicked it up a notch this time. It sort of went into retirement, and I decided that there was, part of me wants to say a market, but I don't really like that word, an opening, let's say, for a type of stronger brown ale. Most of the American brown ales, the hoppy American brown ales, are, relatively speaking, lower in gravity, lower in alcohol content. By lower, I mean like 6% or less. And there weren't a lot of people. In fact, I think there aren't a lot of people that are making stronger American-style brown ales. So that was basically what that one, that was the first effort to do that. To some degree, we may be blazing a trail there. There aren't a lot of real mind-bending brown ales out there, and that one is certainly very strong.
I like the brown ale. We're going to do, coming up this month, a week of just all dark malt beers. So I think we'll definitely have to get this one in, you know?
Okay. Where is this? Who am I speaking with?
This is Jimmy. We're at Jimmy's number 43.
Yeah, hey, Jimmy. Yeah, dark beers, yeah. I'm trying to think if we have anything else. It's probably going to be another month we're going to come out with our Doppelbock. That'll be a once-a-year thing. This is something we haven't made at the new brewery yet. We made it at the bar a bunch of times, but I bet it's been, I want to say, 6 years or more since we made it at the bar also.
So you still have the bar. Do you brew at the bar at all anymore?
No, we haven't brewed here in 2 or 3 years. You know, it's a matter of time and money, and I just had too much on my plate trying to keep... I just couldn't maintain two breweries at once. It was just too much. I couldn't do it. You know, in a perfect world, you know, if I had a lot more money, then I'd be able to hire... somebody else to do some of the things that need to be done, but that didn't happen, and I just had too many things on my plate. Something had to go.
Ray, as somebody who's been in the business for as long as you have, I mean, where do you think craft beer is going? You know, both in terms of Vermont, but also just in general, nationally. Like, what are some of the trends that you see? And, you know, you've been doing this. You've watched things come and go. What's kind of your current take on the whole thing?
Well, I'd like to see all the beers with watermelon and lemonade and kiwi go away. Most of them did. That was a flash that happened in the late 90s. I think Pete's Brewing was big on adding things to beer that shouldn't have been added to beer. So I don't know. I guess the newest thing, and it really, I'm crossing myself off the list here knowingly, is all the nano breweries, these guys that are making 30 gallons at a time in their garage or in their barn or whatever, and making basically farmhouse breweries, hand bottling, hand packaging small quantities of beers for very, very local distribution. All of them are making unique, creative, and strong beers, which they have to do. They can't make let me rephrase that. They could make, say, a beer at 5.4% ABV, but they can't charge $12 or $15 a bottle. And so if you're only making 30 gallons at a time, you can't earn a living doing that. So that's kind of the new thing that I see in the last couple of years, is these very small breweries making these literally handcrafted beers in very small quantities. Other than that, I don't know. What else is the happening thing? We've all seen the emergence and of IPA. IPAs, you know, 15, 20 years ago were a relatively rare phenomenon, and they took the world by storm. I was speaking to my friend Bill Metzger. Bill publishes Yankee Brew News, Mid-South Brewing News, Great Lakes Brewing News, The American Brewer, all the brewing news newspapers. And Bill said he thought the hot up-and-coming thing was Pilsner, hoppy session beers. I don't know. I'm in a good position if that's the up-and-coming thing, because we definitely make hoppy session beers.
That could be. Could be the next. You know, I mean, people want to be able to have something you can have a couple pints of after having something that's more flavor-forward. You know, I actually think, Ray, that the future is recognizing great small regional producers like yourself that are out there that have been doing it for a long time, that have been standing firm, and it's not recognized all over the place. Like, you are what's going to be discovered. How about that? You say they ignore you.
Are you ready to be
forever.
Rediscovered, Ray?
Rediscovered.
I don't know.
I don't know, man. Maybe.
The first thing that jumps to my mind is when Bert Grant at one point said that he wished he had never gotten over, I think 12,000 barrels is what he said. I could be wrong, but he got a lot bigger and he regretted it. So I don't know. Maybe the small regional brewer. I don't know. Who knows?
You got to go to Rome to have a taste, though.
Yeah, I will give a plug for. We have a new product. Well, not exactly a new product, but we are going to be putting out a couple of new things. Jay, you can take notes. A lot of people have asked in the past about our Kolsch and our alt beer. I won an awful lot of awards for my alt beer, Great American Beer Festival, World Beer Cup. I've seen lists of world's greatest alt beers on the internet, and I'm in the top 10 sort of typically. And we are going to be producing Kolsch and alt. I guess I should explain, they are kissing cousins. One is very light in color and one is not, but they are otherwise very similar. And we are going to be producing both our Kolsch and our alt. The Kolsch primarily, and pretty much as a flagship, or if not a flagship, it's something we're going to put foot first out in front of everybody. Green Mountain Gold is the name of that beer, and this spring, March or April, we're going to be putting that beer out primarily in draft.
We've been anxiously awaiting that.
Yeah, you know, something that a session beer, if you will, a beer that's 5.3% ABV, and you can drink a lot of it and not behave like an idiot. That's assuming that you weren't
behaving like an idiot before you drank the beer.
Ray, you're awesome, dude. Listen, one last question because we're our time's almost up. Brattleboro, Vermont, why did you end up there?
Oh, gee.
Big question.
Well, I came north from the Mid-South 30 years ago to go to Bennington College. As I said, I kind of fell into the bar business here in Brattleboro while I was a grad student at CUNY Queens. So I had a business here, and I just ended up staying.
How did the cello, the whole cello thing figure out?
Wait, I got to catch you guys. Oh. So, Ray, we're just going to say, we'll give you a short little sign-off. So, Ray, you have been one of the noted small American brewers for over 20 years now. McNeil's in Vermont. You're available in some small places like New York City. And you can travel to Brattleboro to check out. Do you have a bar? Is it called McNeil's?
Oh, yeah.
What's it called up there?
McNeil's Brewery.
McNeil's Brewery in Brattleboro.
So, I highly encourage people go.
We highly recommend it.
This is a great
destination.
We love
the beers. We've got like four more to drink. And I can only say thank you so much for being on the air. We're going to have to sign off. We'll give a little shout out to Good Beer Seal Bar Events. Come January 31st to the Farm Plus Beer Expo. Maybe we'll get some of your beers down there, Ray. Check out goodbrewseal.com for tickets. One of our new favorite specials, Can Night at Bronx Ale House. Every Monday, January 14th, Mugs Ale House will have a blind IPA tasting. You can check things out at goodbrewseal.com. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com. And you can learn more about us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks to Dave, Jay, and Ray for joining me here tonight on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor, who's back in the studio, and guest coordinator Brett Thompson. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks,
Ray.
Jimmy.
Thanks that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.